Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. Also, the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. Working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 175. I'm recording it on Monday, October 5th, 2009. It's my birthday. I'm 53 today. My mother just called. Made me happy. My boys made me a Lego computer. They say, Daddy's on the computer too much. And they made a Lego computer. It's very kind. My wife's making me a chocolate cake for lunch. So, this is my special day, and I have a special podcast, friends and neighbors. This is a good one, I think. The peak 10 level today is 19. That's on the high side. Stocks offer a better value proposition than they did before the stock crash, but a less than exciting long-term value proposition all the same. The music selection is called Funky Project. Our whole study of investing over the past 7 years in the retire early and indexing discussion boards is a funky project. The title of the podcast is, As Your Wealth Grows, Increase Your Stock Allocation. As I say, this is going to be an exciting one. I'm going to take it slow because it's important. If you don't have any patience, if you're not the kind of person who has patience, you might want to take a pass because I'm going to go through slow. And the reason I'm going through slow is the early steps here are very important. They're going to lead to some gangbuster stuff. But if you don't follow, it won't make any sense. So you won't believe me. You know, the thing I run into a lot in our discussions is we've come up with lots of gangbuster stuff over the past 7 years. But a lot of our community members have been left behind because it's just too good. It's just too good and too big, and they can't let it in. That can't be true. But if they'd listen carefully, now you listen carefully, children, to the early stuff, you got to get the premises right. And if you get the premises right, all kinds of exciting doors open up to you, I believe. The first, now, this is a podcast that goes to some interesting places. I always, when I do one of those, I always like to include some prefatory notes that one, Rob Bennett did not go to stock school, okay, investing school, did not. Rob Bennett has never managed a big fund. So if those things are important to you, you should not be listening to Rob Bennett. Rob Bennett's a guy who posts stuff on the internet. I had built a big community at Motley Fool, the Retire Early community, and some abusive posters attacked our community. These were passive investing dogmatists, and I had to brush up, read some books, and learn about investing to try to protect my community, and it's led to the most controversial series of discussions on money ever on the internet, and called the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate Debate, and we just keep coming up with more stuff, and I think the responsible thing to do is when we come up with these ideas, run them by the experts and see if there are any holes in them. And I've done that. I've run them by everybody I can think of. John Bogle, Vanguard Diehards, Morningstar, Motley Fool, Early Retirement Forum, Bill Bernstein, Scott Burns, Larry Swedrow, Rick Furry, Michael Kitsis, Bill Bangin. I try. Nobody finds any flaws. Some people love the stuff we come up with. They say it's the first time investing has ever made sense. Other people have been hostile. Some have been very hostile. But nobody finds any flaws, or at least they're not able to articulate. They seem to think there are flaws, but if you ask them, they can't explain why. It's just a feeling they have. You know, it's different, so it must be wrong. That's pretty much it, really. But I think the responsible thing to do is just keep trying to do that. Keep trying to put the ideas before people and see if we can find any flaws. Because if we do find flaws, of course, we need to correct our mistakes. I've found a few flaws every now and then. And the root idea in this podcast is actually based on one of the things that was originally a flaw. I got it wrong. And what I try to do when I find one is I put the follow-up podcast. I say, I was wrong right there in the title. That's one of the things that's different in the rational investing model. Rather than trying to cover up our mistakes, let's just get them out there and use them as fuel to come up with new insights. Learn from our mistakes. Wow, You know, what a concept. All right, enough preface. I said something I mentioned here. You know, I had a there's something in the literature on stock investing that's called the equity risk premium. And it's all about stocks. There's pretty much universal agreement. The long-term average return on stocks is 6.5% real. 6.5% real. That's not just Rob Bennett saying that. That's, you know, all these big shots say that. And everybody agrees that's great. It's a fantastic return. And one of the things that academics, they puzzle over, why is it so big? In other words, if you get bonds, I don't know what the long-term average is on bonds, but I know it's less, significantly less, although bonds are higher than things like money markets. Sometimes it's 2% your return. Sometimes less, not 2% real, sometimes 1% real. I think there was one time when it was down to about zero. So sometimes your return on the supposedly safer asset classes are sometimes very low. Not always, but sometimes. But stocks 6.5 on average. And a lot of the academics say, well, that boy, that's an awful big difference. It's just, you know, and they try to explain it. And they have something called the equity risk premium. That's the idea. It's the theory they have, which I think is wrong. The theory they have is that you're taking on more risk with stocks. And therefore, there's some sort of market mechanism where in order to be willing to invest in risky asset classes, investors demand a higher return. So what they're saying is the 6.5 is the product of a market negotiation. Investors would just hold back their money. So I'm not going to put my money in stocks. You better come up with 6.5 because I could get 2% in these other asset classes and I want a 4% risk premium. Otherwise, I'm not giving you my money for stuff. And there's some, I don't know, some kind of entity that says, oh, yeah, the market, they call it. There's some kind of entity that says, yeah, better give them 6.5 or they won't buy our stocks. That's the theory. It's silly. I'm trying to make it sound silly because it is silly. I believe. I've come to believe it's silly. But I didn't always know it was silly. I did a podcast. You'll find it if you go look at the Robcast section of the site. They're all listed there. This was some time ago. And I did one called The Equity Risk Premium Explained at Last. I think it was last winter. And I went through this whole thing where I was trying to explain the equity risk premium. And I think it's a pretty well done podcast. I have it up at my favorites, even though I think it's wrong. I like it because I think it was well argued. And it's thought-provoking. Just because you get something wrong doesn't mean you don't learn from it. I think I learned a lot, frankly. So I sort of like that one. But I think it's wrong. And I did one not too long ago called I Was Wrong. There is no equity risk premium. And that's, I want to expand on that today. But that one, I put forward a statement that excited me. And one of the gifts that I believe God gave me, he cheated me. He cheated me in a couple departments. He gave me no skills at finding my way around the world in a car. You know, I mean, no skills at figuring out where the heck I am and how to get somewhere else. I'm like pathetic. And, you know, no skills with numbers. Not a numbers guy. Not a great baseball player. I told my boys, you know, they play baseball, and I told them, I said, I like playing baseball, but it was sad because, you know, they'd always put me in right field. It's where you put your weakest guy, and if nobody hit anything to right field, it was fine. You know, I could play, and I was okay hitter, you know. But sooner or later, somebody would hit a fly ball to right field, and I'd miss it, and then, you know, then it'd be like, oh, hit more to right field, you know. They'd all be aiming to hit it into right field. So, but God, for whatever reasons, he decided to give me this gift, I think, of being able to sort of sense implications, connections between different things. And I put this statement forward in this earlier podcast, and I said, stocks do return 6.5. That's a fact. Nobody can dispute a fact. It's a mathematical fact. But I don't believe it came about through these market negotiations. And now, when you hear that, a lot of people are going to tune it out. They're going to say, I don't care about theory. I don't care where it comes from. Well, it makes a big difference. And if you stick with me, you'll see why. I'm going to show you why it makes a big difference where it comes from. whether it came as the result of market negotiation or, as I say that the 6.5 is just it's just a, again, it's like a fact. It's the product of the productivity of the U.S. economy. The 6.5, the U.S. economy has been throughout its history sufficiently productive to generate a long-term average return of 6.5 real, and that's it. That's there's no explanation beyond that needed for the 6.5. That's it. It's like standing before a mountain and you just say, yep, there's a mountain. You don't have to explain it. You don't have to rationalize it. You're standing before an ocean. You don't have to say, well, why is this ocean here? Where did it come from? And it's there. It's a fact. 6.5 is a fact. Now, it doesn't mean that fact can never change. It can change. The U.S. could become less productive and that would drop to 6, or it could become more productive and that would rise to 7. But given that we're a mature economy, it's likely not to change too dramatically. So the best bet going forward is that the return is likely to be something in the neighborhood of 6.5. We don't know exactly what. So all the work we do at PassionSaving.com is rooted in a premise that it's probably going to be something around 6.5. And then we figure out how you should invest if you're willing to accept that, that premise. And if you don't, you can adjust. You can change it a little bit. If you think the numbers are going to be different, make an adjustment. But the neutral assumption is that it will continue to be what it's always been in the past, 6.5 real. But for this podcast, the big distinction you've got to grasp, if the rest of it's going to make any sense, and I think it's important, I think you want to grasp this, is does the 6.5 come about as the result of market negotiations where investors are not willing to invest in stocks unless they get compensated 6.5? That's what the passive investors say. That's conventional investing wisdom. We reject that at PassionSaving.com. What we say is no, and everything we reject is tentative. We're putting forward new ideas. I want them to be tested, and if they fail, they fail. But this is what I believe based on my study and the study of, you know, thousands of my fellow community members, what they've contributed. Many have contributed, you know, helpful observations. And based on all that, this is why I say these things. What we say is no. There's no market negotiations going on. 6.5 is what the productivity of the U.S. If you buy an index fund, we're talking about the S&P index, broad index fund. If you or the total stock market index or the Dow, any broad index. If you buy a broad index fund, all you're doing is getting a share of the productivity of the U.S. economy, and whatever that is, that's what you're going to get. And there's no negotiation about it. If the U.S. economy produced 3%, you'd get 3. Whether you like it, maybe you wouldn't like it. Maybe you'd say, I don't like this. I get it. This is not much better than a money market. Well, too bad, buddy. That's what you get in the stock market if U.S. productivity gets cut in half. If U.S. productivity doubles and it's you get 13%, well, the academics, it's going to blow their little minds. They're going to say, how could the risk premium be even bigger? Doesn't make the stock market doesn't care about the feelings of the academics. If the productivity of the U.S. economy is enough to generate 13% real, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get whatever it is. Most likely, it's going to be something in the neighborhood of 6.5, most likely. But has nothing to do with market negotiation. Now, I said that in the earlier podcast where it was titled, I Was Wrong, There Is No Equity Risk Premium. Not too long ago I did that. Maybe 2 months ago. I don't know. A month ago. I don't know. This is a follow-up. But when I said it, I said, this is big. The 6.5 thing is big. The question of where it comes from is big. But I couldn't grasp where. Well, I woke up this morning, it sort of hit me over the head. Here's the thing. What we're saying is, when we say that stocks get 6.5, what we're saying is that's set. You see, when you're trying to solve puzzles, what you want is to have all of stock investing, understanding it is solving puzzles because there's all these moving pieces. And the key to solving the puzzle is always holding. There's too many moving pieces for the human mind to make sense of it. What you have to do is try to hold some of the pieces steady, and then you can look, you can focus in on the pieces that are moving and make sense out of them. But if you let all the pieces move, if you don't hold anything steady, it's very hard to figure things out. And that's what we did with the safe withdrawal rate analysis. We held some things steady, and that helped us figure out how safe withdrawal rates really work, not what the conventional wisdom says about them. Well, same thing here. If we hold that 6.5 steady, if we say that's not caused by market, see, if it's caused by market negotiation, it could change. Investors could say, well, you know, yeah, I used to think I needed 6.5, but now, oh, I read all this passive investing. I know all the answers now. I'm a big shot, and I don't need 6.5 anymore. I don't need any risk premium. All I need is 4%. You know, it could change. But if it's determined by the realities, by the economic realities, it can't change unless the economic realities change. So if you're willing to assume the economic realities are going to remain more or less constant in a mature economy, then the 6.5 becomes stable. And when that becomes stable, look at all the exciting things that follow. It's going to be like dominoes falling. It's going to help us to invest more effectively. Potentially, it could be huge. All right. Stocks are going to pay 6.5. We'll start with that. Or whatever productivity permits, but we're going to say 6.5. How about the other asset classes? Are they set like an ocean, like a mountain? No. A certificate of deposit, the amount that a certificate deposit pays, that's set by a bank somewhere. There's some guy in a bank, and that is set by market forces. That guy in the bank, his job, they tell him, you set that rate, and we want our CDs to sell. And so you're competing with all the other CDs, and you're competing with the other asset classes. In other words, if investors know that stocks pay such and such and they don't want to be in stocks because they think stocks are too risky, they might be willing to accept a lower rate on a CD, but it can't be zero or they're not going to put their money there. So you're competing with all the other asset classes, and of course you're competing with all the other marketers of CDs. So the price, the return paid by a certificate of deposit is set by market forces. Unlike stocks. Bonds, same thing. When a company decides what the bond is going to pay, that is determined by market forces. In other words, that's not like a mountain or an ocean. That's a fact, established fact, like stocks, where it's determined by the productivity of the U.S. economy. The bond is determined by the officers of the company. They say our bonds are going to pay X. They're trying to attract capital, and they have to pay an attractive rate. It's determined ultimately by market forces. They have to attract investors. So that is set by market forces. The bonds, the CDs, I-bonds, TIPS, same thing. They have an auction. So the government, the reason, you know, a lot of people are they marvel that Treasury inflation protected securities at one time were paying 4% real, and they say, why would an investment class with zero risk pay 4% real? It's such a high return for zero risk. But the answer, I think, is that they were new. TIPS were new. And to attract investors, investors don't like new stuff. That's sort of scary. I don't know. They have no track record. So the government put these things out, and not many people wanted them. And to get them out there, they had to up the rate set by market forces. So the passive investors are not wrong to say market forces set returns on investment classes. I believe they're right, except with stocks. Because with stocks, and we're talking about an index fund, not one individual stock, stocks are set... They're set by the productivity of the U.S. economy. I believe, and I stand to be corrected if I'm wrong, but this is what I believe, and I'm building on this belief in this podcast. Well, if that's so, here's something that I woke up this morning, and I this blew my socks off. If the 6.5 is set in stone, more or less, but the alternative numbers are not set in stone. Well, it was bugging me. I was saying, well, there's this. See, we've talked, and you also have to have listened to the other podcast. I can't give you all the titles, but I've been exploring related themes in recent podcasts. And one of the things I've been playing with is that the idea that the risk on stocks is greater than other asset classes, I think that's overdone. I am starting to think that stocks are not nearly as risky as people think they are. What's really going on, you have to use your words carefully. Obviously, if you buy stocks at high valuations, they're, you know, it's like buying a lottery ticket. If you buy stocks at the prices that applied from 1996 through 2008, you might as well put your retirement money in a lottery ticket. You're, you know, it's crazy. unless your allocation is 20%. If you're putting 80% in stocks at those prices, yeah, it's risk, you know, coming out your ears. But that's a choice. No one has to do it. There's no law says you have to buy stocks when they're selling at 3x fair value. All you have to do is take price into account, and the risk goes away. If you buy stocks at, I'm going to pull up the calculator. Let's just say you buy stocks at fair value. Fair value is a P/10 of 14. So I'm just going to pull up the calculator here, the stock return predictor. And let's see, at a we're now at 19, but I'm going to plug in 14 and see what the story is. The risk, I'm going to count risk as the worst possible case. In other words, if you're covered for a worst case scenario, you're in pretty good shape. Well, the stock return predictor says the worst case return in 10 years is a positive return of 0.34. So the worst case scenario, this is a fair value, not today's prices, fair value. So the worst you can do. So in 20 years, the worst case is 2.3, return of 2.3. So what's going on with stocks is, what I would say, instead of saying risk suggests to me you lose your money. And I think what risk, the way we really, a cleaner way of thinking about it, I think, or at least I'm coming to think, is every asset class requires that you give up control of your money for a certain amount of time. But with money markets, you're giving up control for 24 hours. You can get your money back anytime you please. So you're naturally not going to get compensated as much because, you know, you're not giving as much. But with stocks, you're giving potentially, you're giving up your money for 10 years, and that would be with no return in a worst case scenario. Or you're giving up your money for 20 years with a return of only 2.3, which matches the money market. You know, that's going to match a money market, but you're giving it up for 20 years, whereas the money market, you only had to give it up for one day. So, that's, I think, the right way to think about the risk of stocks, is that in a worst-case scenario, you're giving up your money for a large amount of time. You'll eventually get it back. In other words, it's not really a risk of loss. It's a risk of losing control of your money for a long period of time. You're going to have to hold for a long time to break even. That's, I think, a cleaner way of thinking about risk. And in that sense, stocks are riskier, but I think it's a better way of thinking about risk, and it puts things in perspective, because it turns everything into a time game. You know, the question is do you have 20 years? That's really the question. Or do you have 10 years? Some people would say, oh, the risk of stocks is you could have a 50% loss. Well, you could buy at fair value, P/10 of 14, and have a 50% loss the next month. Absolutely. But what I'm saying is, if you know what you're doing, the risk is not a 50% loss. Because if you know what you're doing, you know that 50% loss is going to be paid back within 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, even in a worst case scenario, you'll have you'll break even in a worst case scenario. And in a best case scenario, of course, you'll end up with a nice positive return. The normal return from fair value is something like 6% real. In 10 years, annualized. So in a normal situation, you'll do very well. And in a worst case, you'll break even if only you're willing to hold 10 years. So it's all about holding time. That's really, we can compare asset classes that way. Money markets in that sense, they're better than stocks because the holding time is the smallest, but the return is less. Now, what this suggests is that the return of stocks is fixed, determined by economic factors, not by market factors. The return on the other asset classes is determined by market factors. And it makes perfect sense that the return on the other asset classes would be less than stocks. You know, stocks is always going to have the highest because stocks is the one where you sometimes have to hold for 10 years. I mean, if you don't know what you're doing and you invest not looking at valuations, you might have to hold for 30 years to break even. I mean, you know. The worst case scenario, if you bought stocks during the insane bull years, you could go 25 years before you get even with tips. So, you know, that's that. In that case, the risk is off the charts. But let's talk about an informed investor, a rational investor, a valuation informed indexing investor. even there, you might have to wait 10 years. Or you might have to, you know, 10 years just to break even in a worst-case scenario. They don't come up often, but they can. It's a possibility. So all the other asset classes are set by market forces, and it makes perfect sense that they would be set lower than prices, because lower than stocks, because stocks, you sometimes have to, the reason that the return would be fixed lower is the stocks have this wonderful return of 6.5. See, that's the driving force of so much. So stocks have this wonderful return possibility. And everything else is going to be ranked lower. But the question that was bugging me when I woke up this morning, as I said, well, say that we all became more rational, which is my goal. The reason I record these podcasts is to overcome passive investing. My view is that all of these ideas have been sitting there waiting for somebody to pick them up ever since 1981. In 1981, Robert Shiller, Yale professor, put out research showing that the chances of passive investing working in the real world are precisely zero. What he did was he put out research showing that valuations affect long-term returns. If valuations affect long-term returns, it's totally evident to anyone who thinks about it that the value proposition of stocks is not constant. It varies. Different valuation levels, stocks have a different value proposition. So obviously, you don't want to stay at the same allocation. Since the value proposition of stocks is constantly changing, your allocation should be changing. Your mix of stocks and non-stocks should be changing, not constant. Passive says constant. That makes no sense in Rob Bennett's opinion. So basically, our knowledge of how stock investing works came to a halt in 1981 when the passive investing advocates, they had a great theory. They thought it was great anyway. It produced a lot of insights. And then they found it. The academic research showed it didn't work. And they said, well, we could change the theory to fit the academic research. We could, you know, go that route, which is, I would say, the positive route. Or we can cover up our mistakes. We can all say, you know, we're big shots. We're not going to admit we were wrong. Well, you know, we'll just bully people into continuing to push passive investing, whether it makes any sense or not, even though the academic research shows it can't work. And that's what they did. I don't say with bad intent, but I think they were embarrassed and, you know, ashamed and all this sort of thing. And one of the human things to do is to sort of cover up your mistakes. We all do it. Unfortunately, this mistake affects every investor alive and, frankly, even non-investors if it causes the entire economy to crash. So this was a biggie. But that's, you know, water under the bridge. But that's what happened. So these insights, I believe, these insights have been sitting around for somebody to pick up and run with them, and it just happened that I was put in circumstances where it fell to me to do it. I don't know if that's good or bad, because it's good in the sense that I've developed some, I think, amazing insights, but it's bad in that all these people hate me that you know, don't want to, like, say those three magic words, I and was and wrong. So that's where we stand. I don't like having people hate me. I'd like them to like me. I like them. I'd like them to like me. But that's where we are. Well, let's just say that, you know, we've seen great interest on the internet in learning about the realities of stock investing. So if we can get some blogs to start, you know, saying, hey, let's lift the ban on honest posting at Bogleheads and Morningstar and Motley Fool and Early Retirement Forum, IndexUniverse.com, we can just, you know, burn the house down with all this stuff. People will learn how to invest effectively, and that will change the history of investing. No. We'll all be richer. We'll all be able to retire 5 years sooner, according to the historical data, if we invest it rationally, which means changing our stock allocation in response to big changes in price. Well, what if we all became rational investors? That's never going to happen. That's like saying, what if we all became angels? But let's just say, for purposes of discussion, well, if we all became rational investors, if rational became the dominant model, stock prices would vary, but stock valuations would not vary. If the rational model became dominant, what would happen is the current stock price would price in all factors. And one of the factors, when we're in a recession, stock prices tend to go down. But if you factor in the fact that we're going to get out of the recession and get great returns on the other side, If you bake that into today's price is always going to be a 6.5% increase over last year's price, roughly. So we would have 6.5 growth every year, and volatility would go away. Volatility is caused by passive investing, says Rob Bennett. Volatility is caused by investor emotion. And it's right there in the wording. What do they call it? What do they call volatility? When there's volatility in prices, they call it overvaluation. They say, oh, stocks are overvalued. Well, what does over mean? Over means not properly valued. What they're saying is human emotion causes prices to be irrational. Human emotion causes the market to be inefficient. Not efficient. Inefficient. Irrational. Wrong. Human emotion is the whole problem here. If investors just were rational, we would have no volatility. We would just have that 6.5 every year, year after year. And I think that would be wonderful. That would, all the problems of stock investing would go away. So, you know, this is what I believe, and I was, but I'm always looking for flaws because that's my job. Find the flaws before you make a fool of yourself or somebody else finds them. So, I said, okay. If stocks can reliably, say we all became rational, and stocks can reliably, and of course, even when we're not rational, you can get that 6.5 just by following valuation-informed indexing. In other words, you don't have to wait for the whole world to become rational to take advantage of these ideas. All you need to do is to personally be open to changing your stock allocation so that when stocks are priced below fair value, you buy more stocks. And when they're priced above fair value, you buy less stocks. You change your allocation. And so you get the 6.5 even if the passives don't. The passives obviously can't get 6.5 if they're going with the same stock allocation because they're buying stocks when they're insanely overvalued. When the value probably, you know, when the stock return predictor tells us that the most likely long-term return is a negative 1% and they're going with a 70% stock allocation, they're wiping out their retirement portfolio for no good reason except they believe in passive investing, and passive investing is backwards. It says ignore price, and price is the most important factor. So you're ignoring the most important factor. They say don't change your allocation when the key to rational investing is changing your allocation when necessary. So you can get that 6.5 even if the rest of the world doesn't. But it'd be better if the rest of the world did, because if the whole world did it, or if all investors did it, we would 6.5 would just be, you know, every year, and volatility would go away, and everything would be so simple and so clear. Well, say that happened. I started to think of this as a kink in the theory. I said, say that happens. It almost seems like it couldn't happen because stocks would be providing 6.5. Everybody would know that you get the 6.5 if only you're willing to wait 10 years. In other words, they would know not to buy stocks when they're overvalued. We would all understand that. That would be preached, you know, in all the magazines and books and all this sort of thing. So we would only buy stocks when the value proposition was good. And we would know that even in the event that some irrationality entered the picture and the price dropped, you know, at 50%, we wouldn't worry about it because we'd just say, well, wait 10 years and you'll get it. Well, how many people would then want to invest in bonds or certificates of deposit? What we're essentially saying is if the stock return becomes predictable, which is what valuation-informed indexing is all about, the risk of stocks goes out the window. And I've argued this in several podcasts. I have a podcast called Stocks Are Less Risky Than Bonds. And in one time, I argued that in one way of looking at it, they're not even any more risky than money markets. They, you know, you have to hold for longer than money markets, but if you know what you're doing, you won't lose your money. Your chances of losing your money are no greater. It's just a question of being willing to hold for a longer time period, which, you know, people call that risk, but you don't have to call it risk. You could just call it holding time. And in that case, you've really got a question of, do I want to buy the money market that pays me maybe 2% real, or do I want to buy stocks that pay 6% real? And the answer is obvious. There's always going to be, you're always going to want to have some money in a money market because you're going to want to have some safe. You know, because you might need it next, you know, your car might break down. But for the long-term stuff, you're going to want to be in stocks. Now, note, this is, of course, what the passives argue. You know, this is the pitch they make. They say your long-term money should be in stocks. And they've almost got it right. But the mistake they're making is they say put your long-term money in stocks without looking at valuations. Well, if you do that, you're going to get wiped out in the crash that always follows. Whenever passive investing becomes popular, there's a stock crash. Not one exception in the record. Not a small stock crash, a big one. We've tried it 4 times in history. 4 times we've tried telling people, don't worry about price. We had an economic catastrophe the first time, an economic catastrophe the second time, an economic catastrophe the third time, and an economic catastrophe the fourth time. Why? Because when you tell people not to pay attention to price, you take all price discipline out of the market. The market can't function. The market freezes up. You know, really, you could think this through in 5 minutes. If we were talking about anything other than stocks, every sane person would acknowledge that if you promote passive investing, you're going to bring the economy to its knees. Because you're telling people, if you did it with cars, it would be the same thing. If you told people to buy cars without looking at price, in 10 years from now, every car would cost $1 million because the dealers would just keep increasing the price. Why not? If nobody even looks at the price, why not charge $1 million a car? Same thing with stocks. If nobody's going to look at price, price is going to double. And if nobody looks then, if you keep pushing passive investing, it's going to triple. And if you keep pushing passive investing, it's going to quadruple and quintuple. It's never going to stop until all the money in the world is in stocks. And then, of course, the whole thing crashes. That's what we've done to ourselves. So say all of this were out of the picture and we were getting 6.5. The question I started asking myself is, well, wouldn't people want all their money to be in stocks? In other words, if we really developed rationality in investing, you wouldn't want 100%, but you'd want a certain amount, you know, that you might need in the short term. But most of your money you'd want to put in stocks, and that would be, in other words, stocks understood rationally are more attractive than they are understood passively. The rational model is a pro-stock model, far more pro-stock than the passive model. The passives don't think of it that way because we tell people when prices are insane to move out of stocks. But on an overall sense, the rational model is a more pro-stock model. That's why we're neither bears nor bulls. You know, the bulls criticize passive investing, but they don't like stocks. But rationals love stocks. They just want the numbers to be reported accurately because it doesn't make sense to invest, whether you love them or not. There's no reason why you shouldn't want accurate numbers. So, if rational became dominant, it seems like there'd be an imbalance. Stocks would be paying 6.5, you know, money markets would be paying 2, you know, and bonds paying maybe 4. And the added risk of stocks would be understood to be not that much. So, it almost seems like it couldn't work. So much money would flood into stocks that you'd have a bull market again. Well, I think not. At first, I thought that, and I thought about it a bit, and I said, no, here's what would happen. The stock price can't change. The stock return can't change. The 6.5 is locked in. It's a mountain or an ocean. It can't change. So that wouldn't come down. In other words, you'd have to somehow, this differential would have to be lessened, diminished, because it's too big. This is the whole equity risk premium puzzle. The differential's too big if you understand that stocks are not as risky as we once thought. So I started thinking that the number for stocks would have to come down, and then it hit me, no, that number's not going to come down. What would happen is the return on all the other asset classes would come up. Those asset classes, the return on CDs and I-bonds and TIPS and bonds, those prices are set by market forces. Those prices would be pulled up higher. There's no law of the universe that says a money market can only pay 2% real. Not at all. That money, I don't know exactly what the bank does with it, but they're putting it into productive uses. Well, in the United States, putting money to productive use, building a business, results in a return of 6.5 real. Historically. And I believe in the future it'll be something like that. So, why should somebody putting their money in a CD only get 2% real? Now, they shouldn't get 6.5 because they have the right to take the money out on a day's notice. So, 6.5 is obviously not proper. They're not taking on, you know, they're not willing to give up the use of the money for 10 years. They shouldn't get 6.5. But who says they should only get 1% real or 2? Maybe they should get 4. The market will work it out. But what I'm trying to say is if we can overcome the ban on honest posting on the internet and educate people about how stock investing works in the real world, I think what we see down the road is a wonderful benefit of less volatility in stock returns, which I think is fantastic because it takes all the emotion out of stock investing and it takes the risk out of stock investing. So that's huge. And we've been talking about that for a long time. But the new thing in today's podcast is not only that, we're going to pull up the returns on certificates of deposit, on I-bonds, on TIPS, because as we become rational investors, in order for those asset classes to be competitive with stocks where we know we can get 6.5, because that's determined by the productivity of the U.S. economy, in order to compete, the people, the banks marketing CDs are going to have to up the return to the benefit of the middle class. And we're not stealing anything. We're not doing anything improper. We earn those returns. The puzzle is not how can a CD pay 4% real? The puzzle is, why are they only paying 2% real? And I think the reason they're paying 2% real, go back to that first podcast where I had it a little bit wrong, where I said the equity risk premium explained at last. What's going on is we're not really getting 6.5 out of stocks. And on some level of consciousness, we know it. We have fears. We know, but we don't allow ourselves to know. We block it out. This is why the discussions are so, there's so much friction because we're trying to block this knowledge out. And when people cite the historical data, it upsets us. But we know that the risk of stocks is greater if you're uninformed. If you don't pay attention to valuations, the risk just goes through the roof. And that scares us. And so in our panic, we're willing to turn to an asset class paying only 1% real or 2% real. We're willing to settle for an artificially low return on CDs, I-bonds, TIPS, bonds, so forth and so on. But if we educate ourselves about how investing really works, all that goes by the wayside, and we can demand a proper return on our money, which I can't say what it is, but I feel I can say it'd be higher than what we're getting today. It might be 4% real. That your money in a certificate of deposit would be 4% real and your money in stocks would be 6% real. You should get an edge, but it should not be as high as it is today. Well, that's the exciting news, and I think it follows. I think the logic there is strong. If you see flaws in that logic, please let me know. Use the Contact Rob button at the left side of every page at the website and send me a little email. And if you come up with a good argument, I'll talk about it on a podcast or I'll write about it at the blog and we'll share it with the community and people will think it through. Smart people will think it through. We'll try to get it to the attention of super smart people like John Bogle and we'll try to advance knowledge to the extent we can. All right. So now that's the exciting news. Now, I had started working on the podcast yesterday, and then this thought came to me this morning, and that became the dominant thought. But the question that I wanted to answer in the podcast, and this discussion is sort of preface, because it was in trying to answer the question I originally was posing, I had to go through all this. I had to think it through. But the question I wanted to ask, it's always bothered me. When you talk about investing, with people who believe in passive investing, the conventional model, there's a thing that they're trying, they brought a lot of insights to the table, but there's always been a thing that bothered me. It's this question of, the question in the title, as your wealth grows, I say, as your wealth grows, increase your stock allocation. The alternative, of course, is as your wealth grows, diminish your stock allocation. Which is it? And the passives give two different answers, and it's annoying. I understand why they do it. I've never been able to take them on. I've wanted to, and I just, until today, I didn't feel I had enough information to do it. But they say, they have all this sort of convoluted thinking. And the start of it all is this crazy idea that the 6.5 is determined by market forces. See, they start with that, and they think that's right. And then they say, they have all this stuff. They say, you're being compensated for risk. Instead of just saying that the 6.5 is set by productivity, they come up with all this convoluted stuff about it's set by market and it's set by risk and it's set by volatility and all these things. And they end up making you think that volatility is good or that risk is good. They end up saying the reason you want to have all your money in stocks is because they're the riskiest asset class. And that's crazy. Risk is bad. Risk is bad. You don't want to have all your money. I think you should have a lot of your money in stocks, but not because they're risky. because they're good returns. That's why. And of course, they say, oh, risk is the reason they have good returns. No. They have good returns because you're getting a share of U.S. productivity. That's why. It has nothing to do with risk. There's no law that says if you take on more risk, you'll get more return. If you're smart and you take on risk, you'll be compensated. But if you're a dummy, and frankly, with no offense intended, all passive investors are dummies, not intentionally. They're high IQ dummies, but they're doing something dumb if they're not paying attention to valuations. If you take on risk like a dummy, if you go with a high stock allocation from at the prices that applied from 96 through 2008, you're taking on huge risk and you're getting a negative return. There's no correlation here. No necessary correlation. Sometimes there is a correlation, but there's no requirement. That messes up their thinking. So they have this thing where, you know, this advice just drove me off the deep end one time when I saw this magazine, and they said, you know, what should you do if you're behind in your retirement? You know, some poor guy, he's worried. He's saying, you know, I'm 10 years from retirement. I'm way behind, you know. What should I do? And they say, oh, take on more risk. Go with a higher stock allocation. And they're giving this advice in the 1990s when the long-term return of stock's a negative number. They're saying, oh, what you got to do is take all your money and put it into an asset class paying a negative return. That's what you got to do. Ignore those tips. They're paying 4% real. Put it all in stocks with a negative return. That makes sense. You know, where do they come up with this stuff? Well, the answer, they come up with it not because they're dumb. It's a logical follow-up to the idea that if you take on more risk, you get more return. Stocks were insanely risky in the 1990s. They're saying, hey, you know, why don't they say buy what they should say if they were really logical is buy lottery tickets. There, your risk is sky high. Put all your retirement money in lottery tickets. See, when you take it to that extreme, people see how nuts it is. But that's what they're telling you to do when they said go with a high stock allocation when prices are where they were from 96 through 2008. It's the same thing, same logic, just not quite as extreme. But crazy. So on the one hand, they say, oh, you know, you should take on lots of risk. And of course, they say this with young people. They say young people have time to recover. So young people should go with high stock allocation. Then they say as you get closer to retirement, you know, you got to lower your allocation because you don't want to lose your money. You know, that, again, it follows. It logically makes sense. But then they'll say if you're behind in your retirement, you should increase it again. In other words, if you're 30, you know, high stock allocation. If you're 60, low stock allocation. But if you're 60 and you're behind on your retirement, super high allocation because you got to take them. I mean, these things don't add up. They can't all be true. You know, why should the ordinary retiree go with a low stock allocation at 60, but the guy who's behind go with a super high one? I mean, both of those things can't be right. But passive investors say both of them. They really do. And then they've got another one where they say, if you, Mel Lindau is an example of this. He's the co-author of the Bogleheads Guide to Investing. Now, Mel, you know, he attacks people who say you should look at valuations. But Mel himself has a very low stock allocation. I remember somebody once said on the board, it's something like 20%. And they say, Mel, you're going on these smear campaigns against anybody who has a prudent stock allocation, and you've got 20% yourself. Where do you get off? And he said, oh, he says, I have all I need for retirement. You know, he sold a business or something. He says, I have all I need. And so for me, I shouldn't take on risk. So I don't need to be in stocks. If you don't need to be in stocks, you shouldn't. You just go with the 20%. Well, that idea also drives me a little crazy. Not as bad as the idea of the guy who's behind on his retirement going with a high stock allocation, but this idea that there's some mythical number out there where, you know, just say it's $1 million. The safe withdrawal rate, if it's calculated properly at fair valuation, it's about 5%. So if you had $1 million, you could take out $50,000 a year to live on, inflation adjusted, for 30 years. So what they seem to be saying is once you get, but see, that's only if you're in stocks. But then, see, you get this, it's this weird thing where they're sort of saying if you get to a point where you have enough, you know, you need $1 million to retire and you have $1 million, you should lower your stock allocation because you don't want to have risk anymore. But then they also say if you lower your allocation, you're lowering your return, so you don't have enough anymore. And so so I guess what they're really saying is if you have enough, even with the money, you know, in super safe asset classes, then you don't need to be in stocks. But super safe asset classes sometimes pay very low returns. The return can drop, let's say it's 3%. If you had enough with a 5%, say you had enough, I mean, say it's 2.5 to make the math easy. If you have enough with a 5% return assumption, with $1 million, $50,000 a year to live on, if you're going to drop to a super safe asset class that pays only 2.5, now you need $2 million. So is $1 million enough or is it not enough? It's really not. And I think the whole assumption here is a little bit crazy. The idea that there's some magic number where, you know, once you get to $1 million, you quote unquote have enough. That's not how real life works. Most of us are in a situation where we have a minimum number we have to live on. You know, there's like a minimum number. But then that's not the only number. What we'd like is we're saying, I don't ever want it to go below this. I don't ever want to live on less than X a year. But then you have a high number, which is like, if I had extra money, yeah, I'd go on vacations every year. I'd buy cars. I'd, you know, help my kids out. I'd do all these kinds of things. So most of us have more than one number. It's a range of numbers, that allow different levels of life fulfillment. And so I don't really agree with the idea that retirees should go with a low stock allocation, because if they do, their chance of achieving those higher levels of life fulfillment go way down, because stocks give the highest return. That 6.5 number can't be matched anywhere else. If you invest rationally in stocks, you get the 6.5. If you invest passively, you don't. So I'm not in favor of passives going heavily with stocks in retirement or any other time. If you're going to invest passively, my personal opinion is you should have zero in stocks. Just go with tips. You know, like Zvi Bodhi says, get out of stocks. I'll say this and people will think it's rude, but I would say you're not emotionally mature enough to invest in stocks if you think you don't need to change your allocation in response to big valuation changes. That's my opinion. That sounds harsh, and I don't mean it to be harsh. There are a lot of brilliant people who believe in passive investing, but I don't see any evidence that it holds up. So I would advise people who are passives just to get out of stocks until they understand that passive doesn't make sense, and then, only then, get into stocks. But if you're investing rationally, if you're changing your allocation in response to big price changes, I don't think you should be going with a low stock allocation in retirement, because obviously if the valuations are high, you should. But then that's true even of young people. If you're 20, you should be going with a low stock allocation when prices are high, because why would you want to suffer the massive losses that are always associated with high stock prices? But if valuations are reasonable in retirement, I would want to go with maybe not super high allocation, but a reasonably high allocation, because the 6.5 return is so much higher than what you can get in alternate asset classes. And therefore, being in stocks will allow you to not just get the minimum you need to get by, but to get to those higher levels of life fulfillment and to have something to leave to your kids or to leave to charities, and frankly, to have more security. In other words, if you retire at 65 and say you need 50,000 and you've got $1 million, and say tips are paying 5% real. I mean, they never have, but just to make the numbers work. You could say, oh, I'll put it all in tips. And it won't work. I have to have a differential between the tips and the stocks. Say the tips are paying 2.5 real. Say the tips are paying 2.5 real, and you want 50,000 a year. So you have 2 million. You could put it in the tips and be sure of getting the 2 million. You'd have a sure thing. So that would feel good. But I think you're better putting, you know, some of it in tips, but putting some in stocks so that you're increasing your overall return. And that means you're not going to have to get by on that minimum, 50,000, which is the minimum you feel you need. you might end up with 75,000 or 100,000. That's what stocks do for you, and that's going to increase your enjoyment of life and allow you to give more money to your kids and to charities and all these things. So I don't buy this idea that, see, what we're doing with valuation-informed indexing is we're taking the risk out of stocks. That's really what the project is. The funky project is to take the risk out of stocks by informing ourselves about how valuations affect long-term returns. That's the project. That's the funky project. And once you take the risk out, why not invest in stocks? Regardless of your age. Got to keep valuations in consideration, of course. You know, goes without saying. But why not invest in stocks, regardless of your age? So, then the question becomes, again, you know, I pointed out how in order to study a question, you have to hold certain things stable. Well, holding the question I was trying to answer when I started preparing this podcast is, you see, when people say, what should my allocation be? They're always thinking in terms of risk. And they say, well, a young person, the conventional advice is a young person can afford to take on risk because they have time. If they suffer a big loss, they have time to make it up. That's the theory. And, that, you know, there's some truth to that. But I think that's a misguided way of thinking it through because a young person, they have more years of compounding ahead of them. So when they lose, when they invest in overpriced stocks and they suffer the losses inevitably associated with that, you know, when stocks get to a P10 level of 26, every time we've seen an average loss of 68%. So a young person might only have a small amount of money to invest. Maybe they only have, you know, 20,000. But if they lose 70% of that, they've lost $14,000. Now you might say, well, that's not a big deal. You know, the retiree might have lost $1 million, so $14,000 is no big deal. But they would have had years of compounding on that $14,000. And they've lost all that. They've hurt their finance. $14,000 to a 30-year-old is a lot. I mean, you know, it's a lot more than it is to a 65-year-old. The money is more valuable because that money is going to be used to fund life ventures that are going to produce returns. So when a young person gives up, even if they have a small portfolio, when a young person suffers a bigger loss because they have more years of compounding ahead of them. They're hurting themselves in a very serious way. So I don't buy the idea that the young person doesn't need to worry about losses. I don't buy that. And I don't buy the idea that the retired person doesn't need to worry about returns because we all have this range of levels of life fulfillment. And so the retiree wants to have better returns. You can't just say because you're retired, your returns don't matter anymore. They do matter. So the retiree wants to be in stocks and the young person wants to avoid losses. There's some truth in the conventional approach on this, but it's overdone. It's exaggerated. It's a mistake. So, how do we decide what factors would cause you to increase your stock allocation? I think when you boil down all these thoughts, what you come to is what matters with stocks, obviously valuations matters. And I'm not going to talk about that on this podcast. That goes without saying. We talk about it all the time. But after you factored in valuations, let's take that out of the puzzle because we've talked about it so much. After you look at valuations, what else matters? Well, I would list what matters is risk tolerance matters, you know, how much of a hit you can take. And the passives talk about that all the time. But I think I don't like to focus on that too much because in order to know your risk tolerance, you have to psychoanalyze yourself. And I don't think it can be done. So I think that's sort of a foggy. All these people following passive think that their risk tolerance is super high, but I think they're fooling themselves. They don't know. They haven't been tested. They're not willing to look at valuations. So I don't think they know. I think they're just kidding themselves. But your life goals, that's a big factor. In other words, do you need the money? If you're planning on buying a house or starting a business within 5 years, you've got to lower your stock allocation. Because stocks, you might be down in 5 years. So you've got to, you know, even if you buy at good prices, that can happen. You can be down in 5 years. Yeah, I, you know, I pointed out earlier, it can take 10 years, even at fair value, to get to break even with stocks in a worst case scenario. So if you're going to need the money in 5 years, if your life goals, you know, you're going to send your kid to college in 5 years, you can't, you know, you got to dampen your lower your stock allocation based on that factor. So you have to look at your life goals, you have to look at your risk tolerance, you have to obviously look at valuations. You have to look at, and then the other one is your financial circumstances. You know, how much money do you have? And that's the one I'm focused on in this podcast. And so the question is, as your wealth increases, should you be going with a higher? The question I'm trying to answer is, as your wealth increases, holding all else even, valuations, risk tolerance, life goals, holding all that even, as your wealth increases, should your stock allocation increase or decrease? And my answer is it should increase because holding all else even, stocks provide a higher return than the alternatives. So of course you want that. Everybody should want all else even to be going with higher stocks. But the hurdle with stocks is you've got to be able to hold. And you know, at insanely high prices, you have to hold for 30 years, and so that's sort of out of the question. You just don't want to be going with a high stock allocation. Nobody can hold 30 years. Very, very rare, unless you're Bill Gates. You know, nobody has so much money they can afford to be down for 25 years over what they would have had in tips. But say valuations are reasonable, then you know, from what we looked at, you might have to hold 10 years in a worst case scenario. Probably not going to happen. Probably when you buy at fair value, you'll be okay in 3 years or 4 years, 5 years. But it could be 10 years. Could be 10 years. Who is better able to hold? The person with 1 million, or the person with 100,000, or the person with 10,000, or the person with 1,000? I would say your ability to hold increases with an increase in wealth. The more wealth you possess, the better staying power you possess. The more wealth you possess, the more staying power you possess. I think that correlation is strong. You got a strong hand, you know, sort of like poker. I've brought up poker in earlier podcasts. When you're winning in poker, you build up momentum because the more wins you have, the less shaky you are, the more confident you are. Same thing's true in life and stock investing. As you acquire more wealth, you are a steadier hand. You're not going to panic. You know, we talk about these horrible scenarios where stocks go down 80%. Well, if you have $1 million, you know, $1 million is a pretty lot. You're a middle class person, you have $1 million. You lose 80%, you're going from being in a very, very, very good position to being in a not so good position. I mean, if you're 20 and you've got 200,000 left, that's very good. But if you're 65 and you've got 200,000 left, that's not so hot. So going from 1 million to 200,000 is a big deal. So that's a crushing blow. I call them bone-crushing losses. You know, if you've got 10 million and you lose 80%, you still got 2 million. You're still in a good spot. So the point is, the amount of the hit you're taking, the amount of the punch you're taking, the power of the punch you're taking, is not that great when you have more assets. So holding all else even, you should be increasing your stock allocation as your wealth increases. Or the way, yeah, as your wealth increases, increase your stock allocation. Now, it's a little bit of a dangerous statement because, yeah, people will say, oh, wait a minute, what if valuations are bad? You know, what if your risk tolerance is bad? There are exceptions. You know, what I thought of including in the title is a parenthesis saying all else being equal. To make it accurate, you'd have to include that, but you don't want your titles to go on too long. So I just say, as your wealth grows, increase your stock allocation. The precise way of saying it would be, as your wealth grows, increase your stock allocation, parentheses, all else being equal. But that's an important insight because under the conventional model, under the passive model, that's not at all clear. Under the conventional model, they do sometimes say that. There is a suggestion there. They certainly say that you need to be able to hold. That's clearly in the passive model. And And I don't think anyone would argue that the more wealth you have, the more able you are to hold. But in the passive model, they also say you should lower your allocation as you age. You know, Bogle has this famous rule of thumb where he says, you know, every your allocation should be your age, 100 minus your age. So at 30, your allocation would be 70, and at 60, your allocation would be 40. I mean, lowering as you age. And as you age, your wealth is increasing. So Bogle's disagreeing with what I'm saying here. He's saying as your wealth increases, you diminish your allocation. And Mel Lindauer's disagreeing even more strongly than Bogle. Bogle's idea does make some sense. I mean, Bogle's saying, you don't want this variability in return as you get closer to retirement. And that is rooted, it's a half-truth. It's rooted in something real. That's not a foolish statement at all. But if you, I'm trying to take that out. That's mixing the life goal part and the financial circumstance part, and it's ignoring the valuation part. So it's confused in all kinds of ways. I'm trying to take that out and just saying, hold everything else equal, you should increase your allocation as your wealth increases. But Mel Lindauer is disagreeing more strongly than Bogle, because Mel Lindauer is saying when you get to a certain wealth, X wealth, I don't know what it is, what his wealth is, but what he says is that it's at such a level where he doesn't, quote, need to take on risk. Therefore, he's going with, even though he's a passive investor and he's telling everybody else to go with a high stock allocation at times of insanely high prices, he himself is going with a 20% allocation. Or was. I mean, I don't know what he is now, but these were in the years when I was there communicating with him. And I'm saying no. Now, of course, you're free to do it. I mean, if you feel you have all the money you need and you say, hey, I'm just going to put it all in tips and I don't need the stock stuff, well, fine. That's your personal choice. Perfectly valid choice. None of my business. But I'm just saying strategically, it's I doubt whether Mel Lindauer has so much that earning a higher return wouldn't add to his enjoyment of life. You know, it could be, but I doubt it. Most people, the range is very broad between that minimum amount you need to get by and what you'd like to have, ideally. And as long as there's a difference between those two numbers, you should be aiming for a high return, unless there's a lot of risk attached to it. And Mel is saying there's a lot of risk attached to it, because he doesn't believe in looking at valuations. When you don't look at valuations, you turn stocks into a supremely risky asset class. But if you're willing to look at valuations, you reduce that risk enough so that it's worth taking on that little bit of added risk in order to get a whole lot of added return in most cases. But the real risk of stocks, you know, boiling this all down, what I'm really saying is that the real risk of stocks is can you hold? You know, buy and hold is this popular slogan, but what we've never done yet, because the dark cloud of passive investing blocks us, we've never looked at how do you hold? Not should you hold, but how do you hold? That's the big question in stock investing. And what I'm putting forward in this podcast is the way you hold is by having a strong hand. So you can't wait until you have, you know, $1 million in assets to start investing in stocks. Obviously, you'll never get there. So I'm not saying young people have to invest in stocks too. I'm certainly not saying any different if the valuations are reasonable. But what I'm saying is, all else being equal, the young person should be a little more cautious, a little less willing to put their money in stocks, because the young person needs to acquire enough assets to where they start to acquire staying power. So you start out, yeah, you put money in stocks. You're looking for growth. If the valuation's low, I'd go with a high stock allocation as a young person. Because the odds of getting a huge return are so great. But if the valuation's high and the chance of getting wiped out is high, I would be cautious as a young person. And then as I started to build my stash and as valuations came back to reasonable levels, I would increase my allocation. But all else being equal, having more wealth means having more staying power, and lack of staying power is the real risk of stock investing. That's really the point here. Lack of staying power is the real risk of stock investing. The first risk of stock investing is not understanding valuations. That's the most prevalent problem. But if we solve that, the remaining big risk is you've got to have staying power. And if you have staying power, stocks are the place to be. And the more wealth you have, the more staying power you're going to have. And, you know, if that's all true, I think it is. Tentative conclusion, but I think it is. If all that's true, I think as we explore strategy ideas into the future, I think one of the things we're going to find is holding all else equal, the more wealth you have, the higher your stock allocation should be. And that's in contrast to what John Bogle says, not totally, but somewhat. And it's very much in contrast to what Mel Lindauer said, unless he has so much that he doesn't need. You know, I suppose there's some point, if you have $100 million, maybe you don't want to be invested in stocks. But see, even there, I doubt it. Because even if I was Bill Gates and I had, you know, trillions, I would still want to have money in stocks. Because I'm sure Bill Gates is giving his money to charities, and he gives more if he gets a higher return. And if he's got that much money, he's got an awful lot of staying power. So once you eliminate the big risk of stocks, which is not understanding valuations, the next risk you want to tackle is the question of inadequate staying power. And the way you tackle that is by acquiring assets. Over life, as your wealth increases, your ability to stick for the long term increases, and that translates into strategically wanting to go with a higher stock allocation. As your wealth grows, increase your stock allocation. So says Rob Bennett. Please share your thoughts, and good luck with your investing strategies, and take care.